Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au. I am so excited to tell you that InvestSmart and Intelligent Investor are long-term sponsors of this podcast. And here's something I want to tell you about. The Intelligent Investor Select Value Fund is a unique mix of global leaders and homegrown small caps poised for long-term growth. The portfolio manager is Nathan Bell, a talented investor you may have heard on the RAST network multiple times. The Select Value Fund is designed for investors seeking international diversification and Aussie companies with superior financial metrics. You can invest today at intelligentinvestor.com.au/IISV-offer. That's intelligentinvestor.com.au/IISV-offer. Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes.
Jim, thanks for taking some time to join me.
Yeah, great to be here, Rowan. Thanks for inviting me.
Coming all the way across town to the office and up to level four, it's always a pleasure to chat in person. You've obviously got a very rich history in investing markets. We talked about Melbourne just off air a minute ago and how a lot of your clients and customers are from Melbourne, but obviously across Australia as well. I'm curious though, if we go back and just to set the scene for listeners, how did your kind of inclination and your curiosity for finance start? Like, where did that begin?
Yeah, great question. And thanks for asking me, because it's always an absolute pleasure to obviously delve back into history and the grassroots of where we came from. But my father, Dr. Merv Lincoln, he completed his PhD at Melbourne University in the Economics and Finance Faculty back in 1982. And that PhD or his thesis was titled The Usefulness of Accounting Ratios to Describe the Insolvency Risk of Companies. Now, that particular piece of work formed the basis of credit risk analysis through the 80s and dad had lectured theoretically his methodology and the formula from his thesis to corporate Australia, in particular credit departments and lending institutions. During that time, though, Dab was a self-directed investor too, and he was using his methodology to select stocks to manage his portfolio, in particular using accounting ratios to identify stocks that were at high risk of failure, corporate failure or insolvency, and those that weren't because they had strong balance sheets, they had good, strong levels of profitability, history of profitability, and strong cash flow. So he was selecting those stocks to manage his own portfolio. I came on the scenes in the early 90s because I had a strong computer background and Dad passed his PhD across the table to me when I returned from contracting overseas and said, Tim, do you want to have a crack at actually computerising the PhD and also then potentially commercialising it, because he saw computers as being a way to deliver in that early stage of technology evolution his very manual lecturing process. So that was the idea at the time. So we went ahead and started to computerise it at the same time. Well, we were really developing a credit risk tool. But at the same time, we were identifying this high correlation that existed between the health of a company, the financial health of a company, and share price performance, which became really, really interesting. We were selling Dad's credit tool to credit departments and lending institutions, but the decision-making process was incredibly slow. And because of this correlation, we found that could actually not only deliver good, strong performance in a share portfolio, but it also allowed individuals to qualify recommendations from third parties. Is it a healthy company or isn't? You know, just don't blindly follow a third-party tip. And because of this interest and this fascination that was created from this correlation, we thought maybe we've got a tool here that could actually assist the mum and dad investor or the retail investor, the dedicated DIY investor, to make more informed, confident decisions in the management of their portfolios and qualify third-party advice. So that's really where it came from. And because we were passionate investors themselves, I joined Dad's self-managed super fund back there as another trustee and a member. And so it became this desire to help the mum and dad investor as opposed to following the credit path. And that's therefore that became our chosen commercial path. And that was back in the mid-90s. And obviously today we've grown to where we've grown to.
I'm curious, what did the initial business look like? Was it a subscription, or can you just set the scene for what it was then?
Yeah, we launched Doc Doctor in 1996, and then it was very much delivered on 5 1/4 floppy disks. The very original was the larger floppy disk, but yeah, originally it was the 5 1/4. So that was very much a monthly send out of a floppy disk to members, always subscription-based. That was a great decision we made early on, was to make it a subscription-based service. So you got that recurring revenue, of course. So that was terrific. And if we could build that dependability and the trust with our members and have a really strong retention rate of those members, that recurring revenue allowed for, you know, a sustainable model through challenging economic environments. So, yeah, it worked out to be really good. But obviously the early floppy then morphed into CD-ROM. So then it still was a monthly distribution of CD-ROM. And then in the early 2000s, dial-up internet services became available so we could actually start to explore distributing the updates to the software and the data electronically over telephone lines. And then, of course, today it's fully web-based.
So I haven't heard the story in this granularity before. It's actually, when you think about that and how innovative that is, going like and transitioning so quickly with the medium as well, like adapting to dial up, which at the time, for those of us young enough to remember, wasn't very fast. So to adapt to the new medium and to see the business evolve and thrive over such a long time is really interesting. But you're in a unique position in Australian funds management, but also in the kind of what we're typically class as like newsletter or subscription side. You straddle both of those today. You still have a business that expands from beyond just funds management and goes back into subscriptions and vice versa. And I imagine a lot of your users of the subscription become fund investors and those types of things. But it's often talked about in the media or elsewhere that there are certain advantages afforded to people on either side of the fence. So people that are self-directed investors always wonder, does the professional have some sort of advantage that I don't know about? And then they're professionals that I speak to often think, well, it'd just be easier if I was an individual investor and this is all my own money and I was just managing my own money. So I'm curious if we can just take them one at a time, what you perceive to be the advantages, say for your members who use Stock Doctor for their own portfolios, what kind of advantages are afforded to individual investors? And then maybe we'll look at the other side too, the professional investor.
Well, the individual investor, they've chosen to be true self-directed, haven't they? They're a true DIY investor. So they've chosen to do that, so they're self-sufficient. So with self-sufficiency comes the importance of choosing the right provider relative to what you need to do yourself. So I suppose, firstly, they've got the ability to choose. They've got that. They've got the element of control. So choice, control, they relative to their style. So they're not relying on a third party to direct them. With that, and their smaller portfolio size comes the ability then to invest in stocks that are a lot smaller than perhaps the institutional type investor will be restricted to relative to the size of their portfolio. So DIY investor is very nimble. They've got this opportunity to choose, and that choice extends well below what the institutional investor can select from. And we all know, if you find that high quality, growing, dynamic, small cap stock, and you've got a couple of those in the portfolio, we know the alpha that those types of stocks can produce in regard to boosting the performance of one's portfolio. So I suppose, yeah, the DIY investor's got the ability. It's the number one thing is to identify those small fish and watch them grow up, but also the ability to change quickly, because they don't always grow, or they may reach maturity quickly, or they may be taken over. So it gives them the ability to then fish again, and constantly fish. They've constantly got that line in the water, trying to find that next great smaller cap opportunity.
How about then, okay, so let's take the other side of the table, which is the professional investor, so fund managers like yourselves, right? What are some of the advantages afforded over there?
Yeah, well, we've got access to obviously a lot of research. We've got a suite of brokers who we use who have got really strong research departments, often global entities. So we can tap into some very, very rich and deep research that helps us make informed decisions on companies. We get access to, obviously, CEO briefings, investor briefings that, unfortunately, the retail investor don't, because they don't push enough business through them to warrant that type of access. Corporate actions, we obviously get presented with a lot of opportunities to participate in certain corporate actions, capital raisings and the like. So they're the benefits of the institutional side of things. And yeah, as you said before too, Owen, our members, our Stock Doctor members often migrate into our fund business because they may reach a stage of life where they haven't got the time, desire, or inclination to do it themselves anymore. That's sometimes at the start of the journey too, the time issue. And they know that we follow our same methodology. So in the funds, we follow exactly the same methodology as we do in Stock Doctor. It's just that we do have access to that deeper level of research and resources.
I just realized we've talked around this a bit, but can you just describe at a high level what Stock Doctor actually does? Like, what is the service that it delivers? Because I think my follow-up question would be, how do they use it for their advantage as an individual investor?
Yeah, well, Stock Doctor, with the core competency of Stock Doctor is the fact that we analyse financial accounts, the accounts that companies in Australia are required to release twice a year on an interim and annual basis. And we do that incredibly quickly. So we do all of the things that a lot of DIY investors or non-accountants or non-economists really don't enjoy doing or haven't got the time to do it as quickly as what needs to be done in order to make informed and dynamic decisions. And that is the analysis of financial accounts, the analysis of the balance sheet, the profit and loss statement, the cash flow statement. Do that really quickly with real rigor and a methodology that stood the test of time. We constantly improve, constantly testing environment in the business. So that's got to be the most important piece of due diligence a DIY investor does, is actually understand the true fundamental quality or the financial health of the business. That's our core competency. And that's all based on my father's original PhD work that, as I said a moment ago, is constantly evolving. Mm-hmm. So that's our core competency. But financial health is just one component. It's a massive screening component where you go from, in Australia, 2,000 listed companies, 3/4 of the market are actually don't pass our health test. So then you're down to the 500 that are healthy. From those 500 doesn't mean they're investable. We then apply in Stock Doctor other metrics. So other metrics to identify true growth companies, and they're using traditional measurements with customised factors and criteria applied to traditional type growth metrics, being return on equity, net profit margins, earnings per share growth, free cash flow measurements. All of the things that we've correlated when combined with financial health should lead to a positive outcome for investors. So we apply those other growth metrics or income metrics, sustainability, dividend yield, yield above average market conditions, sustainability of dividends measured on cash flow requirements. So they're under a rule environment that's easy to interpret. So all of a sudden we've weeded down, this is the other power of Stock Doctor, to do it so quickly is to weed down from now the 500 to about the 70 or 80 stocks that meet our financial health metrics and or growth and income metrics. And we flag those stocks as star stocks. All right, so you've got your star stocks that we believe are highly investable, high quality, and meet either growth investors' requirements or an income investor's requirements. But they pass our golden rules 1, 2, and 3. Then it's down to the individual to identify, right, what other metrics are really important. That's when we step into things like, if you're a trend-sensitive investor, what are some momentum indicators that are really important that are highly correlated with those other factors that I've just mentioned that lead to positive outcomes? If you're trend-sensitive, we've got a couple of just simple stop-loss criteria in there under another golden rule. Then you step through to valuation golden rules. Is it a high-quality company and is it trading at a discount to its valuation? Therefore, that represents great opportunity. Doesn't mean you don't have to pay a premium for quality sometimes. And then we get into other things like liquidity. Is there enough traded in the stock every single day to warrant my exposure so I can get in and get out? And then we go through to, what does a company do? Once all of those other metrics that I've just mentioned add up, then what does the actual company do? Does it align with my ethical and moral reasons why I'm really happy to consider the stock further? What's the remuneration of management? Does that align with shareholder outcomes in the past? And have they got skin in the game? Is the founder effect still there? So I've just quickly gone through all of the things that we've identified as being really high correlating factors to really positive outcomes over the long term for an investor, and factors that also must align with the individual investor to make sure that they're building a portfolio of ideally 15-odd stocks that should lead to, again, that long-term positive outcome. But then Stock Doctor goes a lot further than that too. It's got a really powerful portfolio management system in place too for portfolio management. We're fully tax aware. It's got a full charting tool for those chartists out there who love to chart, not necessarily in my wheelhouse, but it's there for those that like to apply some charting techniques, full alerts, full watch lists. It's a fully blown platform to allow DIY investors to be in total control of their investments. And yeah, it's evolved a lot over the last 30-odd years, Owen, and we've got a long way to go yet.
So the funds, do they replicate what happens inside Stock Doctor?
No, it's the other way around. Stock Doctor determines what happens in the funds. So we invest, for example, our Lincoln Australian Growth Fund, it invests in a universe of liquid. Liquid is sufficient trade in the stock every day to warrant our exposure in the Lincoln Australian Growth Fund of Stock Doctor Star Growth Stocks. So that's a strong discipline. So we want to mirror the methodology, but we just can't invest in all of the Star Growth stocks because some of them are just too small. Again, the power to the investor or the Stock Doctor member, because they can invest in those stocks. Same with the Star Income stocks. Must be liquid portfolio in the Lincoln Australian Income Fund of liquid Star Income stocks. So we try to mirror exactly the same. So people are investing in our funds who believe in really the Stock Doctor methodology.
So you obviously employ analysts as well. Does there become a qualitative overlay from the analysts or portfolio managers at a certain extent?
Yeah, absolutely. So great question. So I believe our process is probably 85% quant because it's purely the financial data that's feeding in from numerous data suppliers. So we're a real data aggregator in that sense. So we get the data in, we analyze the data, we filter through the data to come up with our short list of stocks. That's pure quant. But at the end, we do have to check the data, make sure, so this is a qualitative overlay now, come in, check the data, but also understand the active risks. And the only way to understand active risks, whether they're geopolitical, you have a look at the directors selling, there's a number of active risks, rising interest rate environments might have on the individual stock. So yeah, that's the qualitative overlay that is probably around 15% of that, of the total process, but done right at the end before we give the stock the tick of approval.
I've got one deeper question, which is that in terms of the analyst checking the quant-based models, I would imagine with some data that's like particularly smaller companies, it's not as good as you would want it to be all the time. And so you have those analysts that can check some things and whatever. And so more so like the false positives or false negatives. I guess the question is like, do you ever step outside of what the Stock Doctor methodology suggests?
No, we don't. We've got, because we test, we've tested the, we can create the algorithms based on, you know, a high correlation between the factors that we end up choosing from hundreds and hundreds of different factors and combinations of factors. And they're just financial ratios I'm talking about here. We've tested those to have that high correlation. In the past, they've worked to produce positive outcomes, and we believe they'll work into the future with this constant retraining of those algorithms to make sure the algorithms that we use can be applied in, for example, in a rising interest rate environment. Mm-hmm. So they're constantly changing, but no, we won't deviate from the algorithm, especially financial health. There's no way known we'll ever consider a stock that fails golden rule number one, and that's our financial health metric. Any stock that might be in distress at the moment, we still make available in Stock Doctor. It's there still to be viewed, and some of our members might decide to have a specky play in it because they believe in it. They believe it's a turnaround story. And some of them, later, our metrics under Golden Rule 2 and 3 might show early signs of recovery, but we won't ever flag them as a star stock or invest them if their financial health isn't of a satisfactory nature.
How many stocks do you typically end up with in the portfolios?
Yeah, we've got at the moment the full universe of star stocks is around 80. So our Lincoln Australian Growth Fund's got about 35 in it at the moment, and they're similar for the Lincoln Australian Income Fund. So they're portfolios that are certainly not concentrated, and we believe a portfolio of anywhere up to 60 is still quite manageable. It hasn't got too many stocks in it where it starts to dilute the performance overall. So yeah, around between 35 and 50 at any one time in our star stock list, and also in our managed funds. But our clients, our Stock Doctor members, have got the ability to select subsets, the best performing or the ones with the best metrics of those star stock lists. And we really encourage investors not to have a portfolio of any less than 15 stocks, because that's where it does start to become a little bit over-concentrated.
Aside from growth and income, are there any style biases that come through, or just, like, I imagine the system kind of flags those pretty quick?
There's the ability in Stock Doctor to go outside of our star stock universe and run filters on different criteria. And yeah, there's some wonderful, as I said, turnaround opportunities before where they're not yet star stocks, but they do, they're on their way. They're financially healthy and early signs of recovery. So they're there, or there might be some stocks that don't meet our liquidity requirement, even for a star stock. And we need to have them probably around $200,000 traded every day in order to meet even our, what we believe is a DIY investor's liquidity requirement. We've got 4,000 members. So they're 4,000 members trying to all get into a new star stock every day at once. That's going to cause serious strain on liquidity. So you could actually fish outside of our star stocks and say, no, I want an exposure to a smaller cap that might be at $50,000 traded every day and a market cap of 20 mil. That's getting pretty small, but want them to be still financially healthy. So you've got the ability to fish outside. Yeah.
You mentioned, like, your members there in chatting to the team before. I know that the retention rate is very high amongst your members, which is very unique. So for folks that don't know, like, anything above 50% for subscription investment newsletters is considered really good, and yours is far and away above that. Why do you think, what is it about Stock Doctor that keeps people coming back to it? Like, say, versus other subscriptions?
It's a bit of a no-brainer for me, Owen. It's obviously the platform's work. It's really good, and really proud of the way we've delivered and built a system based on not only what we know works, but what our clients need. So we get feedback from them, and we deliver based. We don't want to create a noisy platform at all, but we deliver on things that the population wants. So we deliver for our member. And I think that then extends into two most important criteria. One, you've got to deliver good long-term performance results. If you're not adding value in regard to creating wealth from the share market in the stocks that you recommend, then you're not going to last long. So I think our long-term performance is certainly built a level of trust amongst our members, which is, again, important. But it's our client centricity too, which is a no-brainer. We do pour a lot of genuine effort into servicing our customer and being there for them. And that client centricity, that genuine love for the customer, is there. And they feed off that. And I think that's the difference, because we believe in what we do. They believe in what we do. We deliver the technology to allow them to do what they do, and we're just there for them with this genuine commitment. I think all of that just combined leads to that retention rate that I wasn't ever aware of an industry benchmark. So we just go about our stuff and appreciate the fact that it is around that 85%. So all we have to do is cover 15% attrition each year. Yeah, so it makes me even prouder to know that those basic common sense principles of delivering for the customer and being there for the customer obviously leads to this nice outcome.
Absolutely. Given that you computerized the quantitative model so early, I'm curious how you think about maintaining that competitive edge in the quantitative space, while also we've got explosion of these large language models and all of these things that have been popularized in recent times around, like, on huge data sets, and how you think about that edge and the ability to do what you do, basically.
Yeah, we've been around a long time now, obviously, and we've seen a lot of competitors come and go, and every piece of tech's a new piece of tech. So we've seen that. You touched on it too, that we are probably the original fintech in our space. So that's nice to know. But yeah, it's moving fast now, isn't it? Data analytics, statistical analysis, it's moving fast. And that's, again, that's our core. That's what we do. We're a small business sitting here in Collins Street, Melbourne, but that's core to what we do. And, you know, I've got data scientists employed in the business. We've got our analysts. I've got a dev team. And we believe we're into machine learning too. We're AI. You know, data analytics is all about, and the formulation of factors and identifying the highest correlating factors, it's all pattern recognition. So we're there anyway. It's about us constantly improving now to allow ourselves to remain ahead of that game in regard to the investing landscape, to identify those factors that keep on allowing us to perform, pick the right stocks and perform really well. So we're there. It's a really, really fast moving environment. And I'm not sure where it'll be in 5 years. But again, as I said before, every piece of tech's a new piece of tech. We've just got to keep innovating. And it's great fun. But yeah, it's you've got to maintain that competitive advantage somehow. And that generally is through, again, dialing back to that performance, delivering on performance, delivering a great platform, but still remaining incredibly client-centric.
I've got one question which is more philosophical, which is like in the last few years, we've had like with the lead up to COVID, then we had a bit of a flash crash during COVID, then a massive bull market out of that very short period of time, and then a crash again and heaps of volatility last year. I'm curious what learnings you may have had. Obviously, you've been in the game for quite a while and you've seen these things come and go, and everyone's a new one, but it doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme kind of thing. What are some of the learnings you've taken out of the last couple of years?
Yeah, last couple of years. I mean, it's been long, hasn't it? In my investing journey, I've never experienced. This is new. This is new in regard to the length of time. That it's been tough. It's been tough. Only the large caps. The large caps, the very large caps, they're the only guys that have done well. And if you're in a portfolio that's weighted to large caps, yeah, you've done a lot better than you have with growth orientated or small to mid cap investing styles. And so this has been a really tough period, but it's only because of the turmoil of what we've gone through. And now we're entering into, for the very first time in a long, long time, a rising interest rate environment. So it's very, very different. So I'm now at a stage where we're constantly innovating, we're constantly looking at ways, and we're being very, very tactical in the management of our portfolios in regard to what we expect to occur next in regard to the influence of rising interest rates, or then a plateauing of interest rates, and then perhaps a decline in interest rates and looming recession, what sort of impact that's going to have on our total business model and the performance of our portfolios and our stocks over the ensuing period. So what I've learned is that you need to be incredibly resilient. You need to manage the business really, really carefully, because business is harder to find now, especially with interest rates where they are. People are sort of saying, well, while things are tough, while things are uncertain, while there's a bit of fear out there, better just parking the money in a bit of cash and earning 5% again. That's a totally new mindset to where we've been for so long. So business is harder. But we've just got to now look at ways to constantly evolve and improve and be very tactical for when the bulls start to run again. And they will. It's a cycle. It's a big cycle. It's a long cycle. And it'll shift. It'll shift back in our favour. And we've just got to be ready to go then, but also protect the portfolio and come up with strategies to protect our portfolios and money by increased cash positions, ready for a little bit more volatility that we expect, but then move when those interest rates and the risk of recession starts to abate.
Do you ever, so this comes circles back to like the construction of the Stock Doctor process and the methodology that's followed with the funds, is do you ever make forecasts or have some type of strategy for using those top-down inputs? So things like interest rates, inflation, currencies, those types of things?
Yeah, good question again. Traditionally, we've been very much bottom-up. Purely bottom-up, company level, investing quality of the company and see how we go. And those models have been tested without the benefit of a rising interest rate environment. So now we've got a rising interest rate environment. We can now start to take, and I don't want to bombard it with a heap of noisy macro factors. One of my mantras has always been, or my mottos has always been, to block out the macroeconomic noise, because we are that bottom-up stock picker. But now we're wanting to just have a look at what the effect of perhaps changing unemployment rates and also this higher inflationary environment, what impact that's going to start to have on some companies who have been artificially supported through stimulus and low interest rate environment and the like, and we're seeing bankruptcies and insolvency starting to increase now. Those that are still surviving, what effect are some of those high-level macro factors going to have? So we'll incorporate that now into our testing environment to see if some of the factors are affected, and hence the construction of our portfolios and selection of star stocks may be affected.
And by the way, for anyone listening and wants to learn more, there's obviously links in the show notes to the Stock Doctor website, and you can find out more about that there, as well as the funds. I'm curious, one of the things that tends to happen, so we tend to have on the show, we tend to have folks that are quite qualitative heavy and driven that way, and some people that are quantitatively driven that way, and that's what makes a market, right? But one of the areas where we kind of all are seemingly joined at the hip in some way or shape or form is valuation. So I'm curious how you as a business, you as an individual, think about valuation, but more specifically, where you think investors go wrong.
Valuation, it's what we've got eight golden rules, nine really, but the ninth golden rule is follow the previous eight. And valuation sits at golden rule five. Star stocks are selected based on our first three golden rules, financial health, growth metrics, and also income metrics factors. So that's golden rules one, two, and three. So it sits outside of our star stock selection, but must be considered as part of the investment process. So the way I think about valuation, I'm quality first. Quality, financial health, quality growth, quality income. So I'm all about quality. Surely any asset we select should be based on quality. And then do you have to pay a premium for that quality? Sometimes you do. You know, high quality businesses, high quality assets, whether it be a piece of art, whether it be property, whether it be a business, or whether it be a stock. Sometimes a high quality businesses, you've got to pay a premium for that quality, which might be a really high PE, or it might be a discounted cash flow model, or whatever it is. It might be. So I'm prepared to pay a premium for quality. And where I use valuation and get excited about the use of valuation is when a high quality business is trading at a discount to its valuation. I see that as a bargain. To answer the latter part of your question around where do investors go wrong is by putting valuation as their number one stock selection criteria. Ignore quality and just go in because they're trading at a discount. I mean, that's dangerous. They might be trading at a discount for a very good reason. And to not assess quality ahead of valuation, I think, is incredibly dangerous. And I know there's a lot of industry participants who base the ins and outs of their recommendations purely on value. Dangerous.
You mentioned before the investment process and how that filters down to 500, and then, you know, there's a bit more stringent criteria from then on, and you arrive at around about 30, 40 stocks. I'm curious, because the Australian market, therefore, is probably not as deep as other markets, what does the typical kind of like holding period turn out to be for the funds?
Yeah, the star stock life for a star growth stock's generally around 12 months. So to meet, and we like to think that the growth criteria and the quality criteria that we're looking for, they're elite businesses. But the criteria is so high, like return on equity might be, we're looking for 20% return on equity. We're looking for 10% net profit margins. Unsustainable stuff over the long term as the business matures. So you're going to get a little bit of churn in regard to that, around 12 months. Some are shorter, some are a bit longer. I mean, stocks like REA and Cochlear and CSL, they've been star stocks in and out a little bit over time, but generally they've been there for 20-odd years. But star income stocks, they're generally longer because they're more mature businesses. We're just looking at sustainable yield. So they could be there for years as a star income stock. So growth a little shorter than income.
Well, I've got one final question for you, which is the hardest one, I think, of all the questions that I typically ask guests, which is what's one thing about finance or investing that few others would agree with you on?
And I think I came pre-prepared. Obviously, you flick through some questions in the last 24 hours. So I came a little pre-prepared and I think I just answered it before in regard to valuation. I think I'm not downplaying valuation, but I don't rank it anywhere near as highly as most. And I think most, because, you know, Buffett style is quality and value, but everyone seems to hook onto the value because that's the thing that's able to be measured easily or calculated easier is a valuation metric as opposed to how do I measure quality? So everyone's sort of hooked on their. So I don't agree. I think quality must come first, where I think a lot probably want to run a valuation model before they'll assess quality because it's perhaps easier. The other thing, and golly, I hope I don't get myself into trouble for this one, is probably relates to the easiness of doing this too, and instead of having to analyse financial accounts, is technical analysis. Technical analysis can play a role. I'm not here to can it at all, but to rely purely on a chart to make an informed decision and manage portfolios around purely charting, I think it's dangerous. Again, it's, you know, surely quality has to come first before you look too heavily into a chart, but because it's probably easy and it looks great and it's what everyone seems to talk about, then there's a lot of literature out there and education material on charting. Perhaps and fundamentals isn't so exciting and attractive. Perhaps that's why that occurs. But again, it's dangerous. I think value and charting ahead of measurement of quality probably won't lead to a positive outcome over the long term.
Well, that was actually a really good answer. I really do appreciate you saying that. So, which is just to say thank you. So, well, Tim, I think that's it's a really fitting way to end the show. And there's heaps more information on the Stock Doctor website. Again, you'll find a link in the show notes and you can find out more about the funds and everything. So thanks for taking some time to come and share your wisdom over decades, harnessed over decades with the community today.
It's been a pleasure, Owen. Really, I love sharing the story. We are survivors in what we do. And thank you for inviting me and congratulations to you too on your dedication to educating especially the investment community because, they need generally a lot of helping hand.
Cheers, mate. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that Rask could help you in 2024. As many of you know, Rask has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcasts, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies. Which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best, most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at Rask, which is the launch of our Rask Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high growth strategy focuses on longer term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest. We will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside Rask Core. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community. You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the All-Star Stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios as well as other members-only content. It's called Rask Core. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 Rask community members have begun the Rask plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if, you want to protect your family if something goes wrong. You want to protect your spouse if you lose your job. You want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy. Insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that. But one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, but I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian Property Podcast by Rask, and he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of Rask Core, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this, this is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax. I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nivexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All Rask users get 20% off an annual plan with Nivexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nivexa's software and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nivexa, but they do create some great tools which the Rask community uses each and every day. Number eight, want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number nine, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the Rask YouTube channel. It is completely free and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the Rask network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds, or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that. All of that by going to the Rask Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we are on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. Rask Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the probably, I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the Rask Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us, because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000 and hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support Rask and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the Rask network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.